Welcome to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. This hour, we'll have a look at the Delaware Estuary and efforts to grapple with the problem of microplastics. Also, a local program in Camden County is offering panhandlers cash for a day's work. By all accounts, the program is a success and will soon start up in Philly. But to begin the hour, we're going to talk about America's first esports arena to be built in South Philly, just a stone's throw away from the Link, the Wells Fargo Center, and Citizens Bank Park. Comcast Spectacorp is expected to spend about $50 million on the arena, which will be home to Philadelphia's esports team, the Fusion. What will an esports arena look like? Who are the Fusion, and what does esports competition entail? Joining us in studio to fill us in is Roberto Torres of Technically Philly. Hi, Roberto.
Hi, Mary.
Why Philadelphia?
I think Philadelphia made sense simply because Comcast Spectacorp seems to be really invested in the esports space. They own the Philadelphia Fusion, which is the city's team in something called the Overwatch League. Now, for those of you who don't know what Overwatch is, it is a competitive first-person shooter video game. The kind of game that, you know, your kid might play on a console, but this is the pro leagues, if you will. And so Philadelphia makes sense because it is going to be, as of 2020, the home of that team, which up to now has competed in California. And in this new arena, we're going to see matches go between the Fusion and teams of other teams in the league. It's kind of an interesting experiment to see if around this space that will go up by 2021, Philadelphia will begin to not just have passionate Eagles fans and Phillies fans, but also Philadelphia Fusion. It does seem to have a committed and an engaged fan base already, but this is going to be just the place where the story just gets told.
So if I were to walk into the arena and I wanted to see a Fusion, is it a match? Is that what it's called?
Yes,
a match.
Indeed.
Okay. Uh-huh. What am I going to see? Big screens? How far am I away from the competitors?
Yeah, for sure. So there are standard seating, and you're going to have these big screens where the action is going to go in just dizzying speeds, and you have big colorful explosions, and you have something called the shoutcasters, which I actually only recently learned. These are the people who narrate the games for you, so that you can follow along and see how the Fusion is doing and see what strategies are being deployed. It is really an electrifying experience. You can watch also the broadcasts of the games, and it's something that is really, really interesting.
So shoutcasters as opposed to play-by-play.
Exactly.
But kind of the same.
Exactly.
Okay.
They're going to have the extra insight on each of the explosions.
So where is this arena going to be put in the sports complex?
It's going to be right near Xfinity Live. So one of the things that I think is really interesting about this project is that you're going to have a monument, if you will, a symbol for esports rise as another discipline that has a loyal following. So that, you know, just like we go now to catch a Phillies game, people will go and catch a Philadelphia Fusion match. Now, the arena is named after the Fusion because it is the first esports team that the city has. But I think that we will see through time possibly an evolution. You know, esports is a really dynamic field, and what if maybe Overwatch isn't the hot game anymore? And so the challenge for this project is going to be, what is the long-term sustainability of Overwatch as the game? But alternatively, I think it can also be the Philadelphia Fusion's home, and then also accommodate different sports,
gaming sports.
Different titles that people will play professionally.
Mm-hmm. You know, Roberto, as you know, there are a great many athletes who spend a lot of hours working out to become the best volleyball player, football player, baseball player. Does the esports world consider its competition to be, you know, true in quotation marks, sport?
Well, if you talk to anyone who is doing this professionally, you'll know that there's a level of commitment that goes a little bit beyond what you know from very passionate video game players at an amateur stage. We're talking about hours-long sessions of practice. And because many of these sports or esports are played in teams, there's also the need, much like in baseball and football and basketball, to develop a certain chemistry between the players, and understanding that certain strategies will go up at certain times. And it is really a serious practice. And you know, just ask Dulsta from the Philadelphia Union's esports team. He took this thing very seriously and went from bussing tables at a pizza shop to playing with the official EMLS team, or the soccer game team that the Philadelphia Union has, and now is, you know, touring and going to competitions. So it is very much a serious thing.
And Dulsta Dooley is from Westchester. He's only 18.
True.
Has he graduated yet?
I don't think so.
So he's a high schooler. And as you write, he embodies the shiny promise of esports.
Yeah, because this is a narrative that I think 20, 30 years back, you wouldn't have heard seriously, right? Someone plays a video game enough to be good at it, and then they turn that into a career. It was the, you know, I grew up playing video games, and never at any point did I consider that I was going to be the next Mario Brothers champion or something. But because of these games continue to get more complex, because the worldwide following continues to grow, and also because it's becoming such a serious industry too, you know, some projections of this thing being a $1 billion industry, people have taken it in a next level.
And as you write, he actually does get off the couch.
Yeah, he does.
For
sure.
He's a soccer player for school.
He also plays in real life, yes.
Yeah. So on to practical stuff. Has the traffic piece of this arena been figured out? Does anybody knows if you're attending a game at that South Philadelphia Sports Complex, or if they're, heaven forfend, there are two of them happening at the same time, you are stuck on 95 quite possibly for a long time.
Right. Well, one thing I'll say is that this arena is going to hold 3,500 people. So we're not talking about dropping another link in the middle of that. But another thing I'll say is that this stadium is going to be designed by an architecture firm called Populous. This is a firm that has designed thousands of stadiums, including some really jaw-dropping monuments to football, to soccer in places like Sydney and London. So I think they know what they're doing, and hopefully once this thing is up by 2021, there will be an efficient design to make sure that it doesn't add to the disruption.
Will esports at an arena have the same aesthetic appeal as, say, an Eagles game at the Link does? You got a lot of energy at the Link outside. You know, a major play is made. You know, the place erupts.
Yeah. There's already been really interesting experiences of going to watch Philadelphia Fusion games here in Philly, right? So far, it's been at bars, at clubs, at Xfinity Live once. But this thing, as it's being designed, has some elements that I think will make it kind of a full experience. And we will have to see, but we're talking about areas where you're walking in and you see these digital, very large digital screens above your head. And so there's music, there are training areas for the teams to hang out at. So I think the way that it is designed, at least so far, makes it seem as it will be a very engaging experience. Now, one big competition that this venue will have is people's homes. People are already watching by the, you know, countless hours of other people gaming on YouTube, on streaming services like Twitch. So the challenge for the Fusion Arena will be, can you get those gamers off the couch, hop on the Broad Street line, go down to the stadiums, sit down and watch other people play? The way that these games play out is a really exciting experience, so I think they got a good shot.
Mm. So for players with, say, a team like the Fusion, what is the money like?
What is the money like?
Yeah.
Some of the teams on the Philadelphia Fusion roster make $500,000 a year.
Not bad.
Yeah, some of these
and
are.
And a lot of them are young, I guess?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed.
And so what does the potential look like for this? Because you were talking about what I think, you know, perhaps the gaming industry is worth $1 billion or something like that. I mean, so is there potential to make a lot of money if you
yeah.
are good enough to make it onto one of these teams?
You asked me a lot why Philadelphia at the beginning, right? Mm-hmm. And I think this arena that's going up alongside things like Nerd Street Gamers, which is a local company in which Comcast Spectacore invested, they're working to develop the amateur pipeline of esports players. Between that and the Fusion Arena, I think we're really seeing how Philly might be able to get a slice of that $1 billion pie, because it accumulates, right? It's a sale of merchandise, sale of tickets for these events. membership fees or rather championship fees for people trying out to get into these games, there is a potential for this to become a substantial industry here in Philadelphia and hopefully drop a pin in the national map of esports destinations. I will say that this stadium has the it is going to be the first purpose-built arena in the country. There are already esports arenas elsewhere, but this is the first that's going to go ground up, designed to house esports matches.
And when does this open?
2021.
And that's when the Fusion moves to...
So the Fusion is currently...
From California to Philly.
No, the Fusion is currently playing in California.
Right.
And so the 2020 season, they're going to move the team to Philly. They're going to play in some rather, some temporary spaces. They're talking about hosting some games in down to the shore in Atlantic City. And so by 2021, the plan is that this will be the venue for the upcoming matches.
So the regular season for the Overwatch League is underway. How are the Fusion doing?
They're doing good. I think the last game they did lose, but they've been doing some really interesting strategies, and it's definitely among the teams to watch.
So again, Roberto Torres, you are a writer for Technically Philly. What are you hearing from your readers about this arena?
It is very much a topic that divides our readers.
Really?
There's really interesting. There's a lot of passion, and there's people who are interested in seeing Philadelphia become an esports hub. People who believe in this movement as something that might bring an additional element to an overall tech community. There's also an interesting overlap between the regular sports. The Philadelphia Union is really committed to its esports team, and our readers really are interested in that. But there's also, detractors.
Naysayers, really. What are they saying?
As with anything, people can't believe that others are playing, getting paid to play video games. A lot of people say it's not sustainable. But when you see the level of commitment that people have to esports, hundreds of thousands of viewers for online matches, you can at least see that there's some very passionate individuals that are turning they're making their lifelong childhood dream of playing video games for a living into reality.
And there's more building ahead for that site from Comcast Spectacore?
Yes. It is part of an overall strategy that Comcast Spectacore has for the Philadelphia Sports Complex. There's also going to be an office building going up nearby that will likely try to draw in tech companies. So kind of seeing the sports complex step into the future really in an interesting way.
So speaking of the future, Roberto, what do you see for this arena? It opens in 2021. So say 2025, 2026. What do you envision? Do you envision success or what do you think?
Well, like I said, the challenge for the Fusion Arena is to get people who are already watching esports matches to get off the couch and head down to a physical place and do this thing live. The way that I know Philadelphia sports fanatics and the way Philadelphia feels passionate about anything, I think we're really going to see something interesting coming in and around the Fusion Arena.
All right, Roberto Torres is lead reporter for Technically Philly. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And up next, we're going to talk about a program in Camden that's starting in Philly, which pays homeless people cash for a day's work. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. We're going to take a look now at a program in Camden County, New Jersey, which gives panhandlers a chance to earn cash by doing a day's work. Work Now was launched by the county last year, and since then, approximately 400 people have participated. The model has worked so well that a version of Work Now will launch in Philly next month. And joining us to tell us more about the program is Samantha Matlin, Director of Evaluation and Community Impact at the Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation. Samantha did an evaluation of the Work Now program for the Philadelphia Initiative. And this note, Scattergood is a supporter of behavioral health reporting at WHYY. Samantha Matlin, so nice to have you with us.
Thank you. I'm such a fan and really so honored to be here.
Oh, thank you. Well, to start, we should make a distinction between the terms panhandler and homeless. Many panhandlers are homeless, but not all are without shelter?
Correct. And we're really focusing in this program on individuals experiencing economic insecurity. So you know, homelessness can mean lots of different things. It can be people who are just kind of vulnerably housed. They might be in a shelter or staying in someone's house for a temporary time. So they might be street homeless. And for individuals who ask for money on the street, that may or may not mean that they're homeless. It may be that they are trying to support, you know, not making enough money, not having enough through benefits.
And you're not calling this a day labor program, but rather a same day work and pay program. What's the difference?
Correct. So, you know, day labor has a history of somewhat of a negative connotation. So day labor programs in a traditional sense often worked with individuals who were thought of maybe as undocumented individuals who were not eligible for traditional paying jobs. The type of work was also traditionally more physical work that may or may not been safe, that were the types of jobs that maybe other people wouldn't want to do. So we really wanted to stay away from calling it that and also not doing that kind of work and not focusing on that population. And we're really talking about individuals who want to work, who may have barriers in their lives, maybe system barriers, like they'd been incarcerated and they're having trouble finding jobs, or maybe they don't have an ID and they're struggling to figure out how you go through the process of securing employment.
And this work does not require an ID, does not require drug testing?
Correct. So the program is really, some people refer to these as low barrier workforce programs. So they're really intended for individuals as long as they can safely perform the work, right? You don't want anyone to be doing things that are unsafe, but there'll be no drug screening. There's no requirements for an ID. They only have to give a name so that they can be paid at the end of the day. But we're really lucky in Philadelphia to have programs like First Step Staffing that are ready to work with individuals who can pass a drug screen, who with some coaching are ready to do some more sustained temporary employment with hoping to get full-time employment.
So that's the next step.
That's the next step. Hmm. And we're so lucky in Philadelphia to have that next step because a lot of programs, including in Camden, when they launched these First Step programs, didn't really have that next step. So this is sort of the beginning, but this is not the end, right? The goal is not to have someone make a day's pay and then be done.
Let's go back to work now in Camden for just a moment. Tell us about a typical day spent looking for workers. How does that routine go? Do you start at 8 in the morning and do you go to a certain area where you know people congregate?
Yeah, so their program, which is supported by Camden County, and it's run through Volunteers of America sort of as their operating entity that provides the opportunities for work, but also access to other services and supports, which is so critical in these programs, is really to use it as an entree for individuals who do want other things. Some people may not, and that's fine. And so it's a little bit different in Camden than it'll work here. They have a person go out and look for individuals, maybe coming from a shelter, maybe being on the street and saying, hey, do you want to make money today? And it's really
Did they flash an ID badge?
Yes.
So they know it's legitimate?
Yes. And so that's what we interviewed some of the guys that are participating in that program. And at first when it started, it was like, yeah, but is this legitimate work? And now folks in Camden, word of mouth, they really know. They know the van. It's a Volunteers of America van. And unfortunately, in Camden, there's much more interest in the work than they have slots or, you know, opportunities to pay. So they move around from day to day looking for folks, but they don't stay in the same spot because then there's just too much demand. Mm-hmm. And that's been one of their challenges that we're also really trying to be thoughtful about, is that the last thing we want to do is say we have this opportunity and then it's not available.
So what sort of work, and is there an effort to expand the opportunity?
Yeah, so in Camden, and it's interesting, in the other programs across the country, including Albuquerque, where this really started, the work, because it's supported by city government, is more jobs through like parks and recreation, might be lot cleanup, cleaning up of landscaping and those kind of jobs. And so that's what Camden folks are typically doing. So that's what their work entails.
And in Philly, it'll be a little bit different.
Yes.
It'll be working with public art.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, so we're so excited. And I have to say, Scattered has really been a facilitator, and we've really been trying to learn best practices and share that with the group, but we're really not the implementers of the work. And so I have to say that we've been really fortunate to have philanthropic support here in Philadelphia, which is different than the other places that have done this. And so both the Scheller Family Foundation and the Barra Foundation have supported this work. And because Philadelphia has such rich assets, and I think philanthropy can be really creative with how we use funds, and I think that's our charge in philanthropy. There were conversations about, well, what would this look like if we used participatory art as a way of having work and meaningful work? And we know through both anecdotal and more experimental evaluations of mural arts work that we know that hope and feelings of improvement and feelings of contribution are so important when you're helping to improve the aesthetic of our community. And we know that mural arts already has the credibility and relationships so that we hope that that trust will extend to this work. And so
They'll be working on murals. Painting murals.
They will be painting work in the concourse. In the SEPTA concourse, which is great for a number of reasons. One is, I think, this contribution to art, and I'm a huge mural arts fan, so it's a great opportunity. But the ability to help improve the built environment around folks, we know has an impact on our mental health. And so that's really exciting. And the other thing that's great about that is, of course, the concourse is a very public space. And so part of the issues around individuals experiencing economic insecurity is that we have this notion that people maybe don't want to work or don't have skills. And we know that that's really not true for the majority of individuals. And so for the opportunity for the public to engage with the art making and say, oh, what are you doing? And really seeing us help improve something. And then I will want to say that another difference in our Philadelphia program is that we're also going to have peer supports involved. So this partnership includes a partnership with Mental Health Partnerships, which really is a wonderful advocacy organization for individuals with behavioral health issues, and really does a lot of our training in Philadelphia around becoming a peer support specialist.
So peer support, meaning when you're looking for folks in Philadelphia to participate in mm-hmm. this mural arts program mm-hmm. At the SEPTA concourse, mm-hmm. if they have apparent mental health issues, that might be okay because they'll be working with peer specialists who can help them work on the mural?
Yeah.
Okay.
So the peer support specialists are really there to engage and build relationships and to help individuals, first of all, with lived experience themselves. We know that seeing people with similar situations that have been able to overcome them can be very helpful in our own recovery process. And so part of it is there and saying, hey, we're here. When you want to engage, we're here for you, and kind of seeing that model. But if folks say, hey, I need help with housing, I need help with healthcare, medication, ID, that we'll have a person there, actually two people, to help support that process.
So how in Philadelphia, how will you go about finding the folks who will participate in the mural arts mm-hmm. program? And how much will they make per day?
Yeah. So this has been a big source of trying to figure out because we don't want to create such a demand and not be able to meet that. And so we've been talking to two organizations primarily. One is that Project Home has the Hub of Hope in the concourse. And so as you probably know, the Hub of Hope is a place where people can go at any time during the day and get basic needs met, like food and taking a shower and doing laundry, but it's also an access point for housing and healthcare and legal services, among other things. And so we've been talking to them, since we will be sisters in the same space, about what if folks come in and say that they're looking for work, and how do we collaborate to be a kind of referral source? And I use that word very loosely, referral. This isn't going to be a very, arduous process to get into a service.
And it's a small program, too. You've only got a handful of folks participating to start.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's about 10, maybe up to 15 people a day. And our other collaborator is Broad Street Ministry. And so Broad Street Ministry also provides, you know, similar access to basic needs and then other support services. And we know in talking to them that a lot of people come there also looking for work. And so we're working with them to figure out how to best support capacity issues. And in terms of how much people make, it'll be $50.
In cash.
Yeah, we are.
Are you ever concerned about where the cash might end up, or have participants been concerned about being paid in cash?
Yeah. And so this is something that, you know, it's, I can't tell you how many hours we've spent talking about this and asking other cities what they do. I think it's something that it sounds kind of scary, but then in the, you know, really talking to people, it hasn't been an issue. And so we really don't want to make it an issue. We want to be, of course, smart and careful, just the way you and I would be if we were paid in cash at the end of the day. So we want to be thoughtful about that. You know, this is work that's happening during the day in the middle of our city, which is a very safe place to be. The other thing is we are going to talk to participants and say, hey, if you don't feel comfortable being paid in cash, we're going to make sure to have a check card that functions like a debit card with no fee to them, if that's a preferable way to be paid. And something that's such a luxury with this program is that the funding support allows for us to start the work for 28 weeks and then take a break and make sure, like, hey, what's working? What's not working? Do people not want to be paid in cash? We thought that was something that people prefer. They prefer that in Camden, but this is Philly, and maybe there's a difference. So
let me reintroduce you. Samantha Matlin is with the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation. And one question that comes to mind is if somebody comes up to you and it's apparent they can't work because, mm-hmm. say, they're visibly inebriated, mm-hmm. how do you handle that?
I think this is what's so nice is that we're going to have a team of supports there. And so if someone comes in that, you know, maybe they're not sober that day, but they can sit and paint, I think that's okay. If someone seems like they're really not in a place to do that, then, you know, maybe it's providing breakfast, talking to them a little bit, saying, you know, do you want to come back tomorrow? You know, what are you interested in? How can you get here tomorrow? You know, what's going to be different tomorrow than today? And really working with people with where they're at. And that's the kind of the whole point of this program is that we really can work with people with where they're at, making sure that people are staying safe, that the group is safe. But the fact that we'll have peers there, we'll have flexibility to really support people's needs.
You are listening to WHYY in Philadelphia. Let's get to some questions. Kurt asks, how can people get involved to volunteer with this on the other end? How can I help?
That's so wonderful. Thank you. That's a great first question. And so that's something we've really been thinking about as well. So Mural Arts typically, as probably the listeners know, often have community paint days where folks are really invited in, including children and folks from all walks of life in the community to participate. And so right now we don't have formal programming around that. But I will say the Mural Arts program has a body of work known as the Porchlight Program. And the Porchlight Program is a portfolio of really around murals focused on behavioral health issues. And they do have community paint days quite regularly. And so I would encourage listeners to go to Mural Arts and the Porchlight Program and look at what's happening. They have a storefront in Kensington, which is really doing some amazing outreach to individuals and providing really critical services and support. So there's lots of opportunities to volunteer. I love that folks are interested in doing that. I would also say that people should come down to, you know, not all of our listeners here, but that maybe there's a way to come down to the concourse. And if you see that happening, like, hey, great job. You know, even a smile for someone that is feeling sort of alienated or marginalized in our community can make such a difference. And so I think trying to look for that kind of opportunity is helpful as well.
Question from Ron. Does the program in Philadelphia include women and men?
Yes, great question. And I apologize. I was particularly talking about men. So most of the programs have been majority males that have participated, but that is not always the case. And so I don't think that miners will be participating. That's not really who comes to the entree points that we've talked about. We have more young adults and adults. But actually, the population that's experiencing economic insecurity is getting younger. And so it is something to be thinking about. It was traditionally a little bit older males, but we are seeing, particularly in our city and partly because of the opioid epidemic, we are seeing younger and younger individuals seeking support services.
So both these programs in Camden County and coming up in Philadelphia do provide a pathway to other, perhaps more steady work, and even housing, and even behavioral health treatment. Tell
yes.
us about that.
Yeah, so it's really person-centered, meaning, you know, what do people want and what are people ready for? And that's really important. But we want to be ready as a service system, as a provider, myself as a psychologist, to say, what can we help you with? And so I think as we have more Housing First programs and programs with less requirements for participation, that we hope that people will be more interested in accessing them. I've been sort of struck doing this work. Sometimes it's very little things that make such a difference.
Such
and
so, as?
An ID, right? Like,
toward getting, is a barrier toward getting work.
Getting yeah. work, getting access to services, getting access to food benefits. Really, it's just such a small thing. But, you know, I know if I were to lose that, I could call my parents and they could help me through a birth certificate process.
Sure.
And so things like that. We know also for individuals on Medicaid that sometimes paperwork gets lost. Those forms can be cumbersome. And so if you're kind of getting on and off your benefits, that can be something where you had housing, you were eligible for something, and then not.
We have about a minute left. Is there a favorite story of a client who's found success in this program that you'd like to relay?
Great, great question. You know, we had the opportunity to talk with three of the gentlemen that have participated in Camden, and I was just so inspired by them. All three of them really were ready to work. And because of challenges around housing, challenges around incarceration in their past, and challenges with substance use, really felt like there wasn't going to be an opportunity for them to work. And I'm so pleased to say that all three of them now have been hired for more permanent work through the county. They're all on their way to more permanent housing. And they're just inspiring. And I think the biggest thing that I got from them is that they now feel like they can trust a social support service that really has their best interest at heart. And they feel hopeful about their futures. And they also feel efficacious that they have something that they can do to improve that.
Samantha Matlin, an exciting program to watch.
Thank you.
Samantha is the director of Evaluation and Community Impact at the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation. Thanks for joining us. And coming up, we're going to talk about the problem of microplastics in the Delaware Estuary. Some federal funding is coming along to help clean up that problem. We'll hear about that in just a moment here on Radio Times. Stay with us. You are listening to the Radio Times Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Environmental groups have been celebrating the news recently that just over $4 million in federal funding has been set aside for projects to help preserve forests, wetlands, and floodplains in the Delaware River watershed. That funding includes $121,000 to identify and clean up sources of microplastics. Jonathan Cohen is an associate professor at the University of Delaware College of Earth, Ocean, and Environment School of Marine Sciences and Biology. He's here now to tell us more about efforts to eradicate microplastics and how microplastics affect fish, other wildlife, and the environment as a whole in the Delaware Estuary. Welcome, Jonathan.
Well, thank you.
Let's begin with a quick refresher of what the Delaware Estuary is. According to the Riverkeeper site, it's 134 miles long, and it begins in Trenton and goes south all the way to the mouth of the Delaware Bay?
That's correct, yeah. So if you sort of think about a map of the East Coast and you think about where Philadelphia is and Camden right across the way, you have the Delaware River that comes down with the watershed stretching all the way up to New York. And then that water flows down past Dover, Delaware, and then eventually out into the Atlantic Ocean past Cape May, New Jersey, and Cape Henlopen, Delaware. And that sort of region is the Delaware Estuary, where you have salt water coming in from the ocean being diluted by fresh water from land runoff all the way up through New York.
And getting to microplastics, how tiny is a piece of plastic to be called a microplastic?
So the cutoff is about a quarter of an inch. So if you think about maybe a grain of rice, that's sort of the size that we're talking about. So you can have larger pieces of plastic that can be broken down into that size scale, or you can maybe have things like microbeads that were more common in sort of facial cleansers and things like that, that are manufactured to be that small.
And they're no longer allowed in products, correct? Microbeads?
Correct. They've been banned in the U.S. and also in the United Kingdom and elsewhere.
What sort of threat, John Cohen, to animal life do microplastics pose in the Delaware estuary? Animals like fish and oysters and et cetera.
Great. Yeah. So, I mean, that's a question that I think is open in a lot of ways. The kind of effects that we anticipate might fall into two categories. One is if you just sort of nutritional inadequacy. And so if you eat a lot of candy bars, you could eat candy bars for breakfast, lunch, and dinner and not have a very healthy diet. It's going to mean that you're not going to get the nutrients you need. So microplastics might be doing that. You know, so they take the place of quality food, algae, for example, that would be important for oysters and zooplankton, or if you're thinking about fish, smaller fish. So they might just be something that gets eaten and then takes up the space that that good quality food would have, so the organism doesn't have the nutrients it needs. The other thing is when you ingest those materials, it's possible that there are compounds that come out of that plastic, whether it's the plasticizers that are used for the plastics to hold together, or whether it's other toxic compounds that might be attached to that plastic or adsorbed to the plastic, things like polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons and things that might be more familiar as sort of a pollutant.
And how does that affect the animal?
It could affect their ability to reproduce and the overall health of the animal. They can also get passed on to higher trophic levels. And so if you have a smaller fish that ingests this material, then it gets that fish gets eaten by a larger fish, and then that fish eats a lot more of smaller fish, then you can accumulate that and ultimately pass it up to the top predators, things like birds, and then potentially also humans.
John Cohen, let's talk about your work in the field. What do you do to measure the amount of microplastics in water and on the beach and in animals? What are the processes like?
Sure. So in terms of the water sampling, we go out on boats and we take nets and we tow those nets through the water. And then the organisms get caught in the nets, and we measure how much water we are sampling at that time. And what we're able to do is through some chemical processes in the lab, we can isolate those microplastics. We can digest away all the carbon-containing organic material, the organisms and the plant fibers. And then we make the water very salty, and that floats the microplastics to the top, and then we can collect them and then look at them under the microscope. We can do some processes where we can determine which plastic they are. Ideally, we'd love to know where they came from. That's out of our reach at the moment. And we can do the same things with beach sands. You collect a sample of sand on the beach, and you can use the same sorts of processes to isolate the plastics. And then in terms of the organisms, you can collect the organisms like a fish, and you can dissect out the gut, for example, where the plastic would be, or the same thing with an oyster. You could look at its gills, which is part of the feeding mechanism for an oyster, and then you can look for plastics there.
Are microplastics everywhere?
They're everywhere that we've seen, you see that in the scientific literature as well. They seem to be pretty ubiquitous. The big question is, are they concentrated by the currents? Are they concentrated in organisms? So those are still open questions, and that's one of the things that we're really focusing on in Delaware Bay is, are there maybe physical mechanisms that are related to how the water moves that might be concentrating the plastics?
Which sorts of plastic products are the biggest culprits? Plastic bags, you know, water bottles? What's the worst?
Yeah. So it's hard to tell from our end. So we see a lot of polypropylene and polyethylene plastic, which is used in all sorts of products. And so, again, it's the holy grail for us is to try to figure out exactly which plastic it came from, which product it came from. So what we can do is we can determine which kind of plastic it is, but it's really hard for us to determine sort of the ultimate culprit.
At the top of the segment, you know, we mentioned the $121,000 in federal funding that's going toward the exploration of the microplastic problem. How is this going to help you? What does this money go to in your effort to resolve the problem of microplastics in the Delaware estuary?
Sure. So I'm based in Lewis, Delaware, sort of near Cape Henlopen, and so a lot of our work is based in the lower portion of the Delaware estuary. And those funds are going to particularly focus on some of the upper reaches of the Delaware River closer to Philadelphia in that region. And so for us, it's a great opportunity to have more data be collected on the sources of plastic, really to kind of get at the question that you just asked about sort of what is the culprit, so we can try to know more about production of these things, and then also plastics in the water, more in the Delaware River. That's an area that we've have tried to do some sampling in, but again, just because of time and distance, when we sample, our sampling tends to be focused in the lower portion of the estuary. So it's going to be very important for that, and also to think about the land-water connection. I think there's more focus on sort of the watershed and how the land drains and interacts with the water. And so to try to understand plastic pollution on the land and how it affects the water is going to be a really useful part of this new work.
Well, we're going to get to that in just a second, but what sorts of animals are in the upper part of the estuary, and how are they negatively affected or even suffering with the microplastic issue?
So there are fish, and there are in the water column, there are a lot of, you would sort of pick them up and think that they're little shrimp-like things. You know, scientifically, we put them in all kinds of different categories, amphipods, for example. But so those organisms then become food for fish. And there's also a region sort of where the river comes down and meets the lower portion of the estuary near Delaware City, so a little south of Wilmington, where the water tends to remain for a while, and it gets trapped in circulation of the estuary. And so we think that, and that's a place for a lot of fish and these little shrimp-like organisms as well. And so that's it's an important spot in the estuary. And so to think that, you know, that the microplastics, if they even are more produced in urban areas and come from urban areas, they're going to get trapped there in the estuary. And so we're trying to understand those processes. So it's those fish and shrimp-like organisms that are the targets. How they're affected, we know if you take an individual, that those individuals can suffer the way that I've suggested, where you have sort of poor quality food or potentially even toxics moving from the microplastics to the organism at the individual level. But the question that we still have is, how does that affect the population?
All right. So no surprise, researchers have found a higher concentration of microplastics in urban areas. And Catalina Jaramillo wrote for WHYY's Plan Philly recently that one of the biggest issues in the Philly area is that storm drains in the city are catching a lot more than stormwater runoff, which is what they're built for. Any plastic that can get through the grate then goes on to a trip to eventually where?
Yeah, so it can come into the estuary. And the tricky thing with that as well is that it seems like there are areas on the shoreline that are aggregating plastics as well, which kind of feeds into maybe one way to think about cleaning up these things is it doesn't all just stay in the water. Some of it will go back to the shoreline and get trapped. So these areas of the shoreline which just aggregate a lot of material, which can then break down over time, particularly with ultraviolet light from the sun, can break down these plastics and then make them into these smaller microplastics.
How long a period of time does that take?
It depends on the plastic, on the order of years. So, there's been some studies where actually organisms can break down things like a plastic bag, and that can happen much more quickly. But otherwise, the sun gets brittle. You might have experienced this if you have a beach toy, perhaps, in the backyard that's out there for maybe a winter that you didn't expect, and then it can break down even the next spring.
Sure. Well, let's talk about the plastic bag issue for just a moment. At last count in New Jersey, 19 towns, many of them along the shore, have either banned or will ban plastic bags. I believe there is legislation in the works in Delaware, which has found some co-sponsors to ban plastic bags. And in Philadelphia, City Councilman Mark Swilla has said he will raise the issue of plastic bags to ban them again this year. But with the initial efforts, at least in New Jersey, are you seeing fewer plastic bags as litter when you are out in the field in the Delaware Bay area?
It's not something that we've measured. There are studies that look at beach debris. And I'm not sure what the results are over time from those. I think the thing that plastic bag bans do is they in a very real way make the consumer aware of their impact by using plastic. And so I think that that perhaps more than sort of an immediate effect on sort of floating plastic bags, what it does do is create an awareness of the issue. And then that perhaps can filter into other aspects of your consumer life.
Are they one of the worst offenders when it comes to microplastics?
Because microplastics are small, a lot of what we see are fibers and fragments of sort of harder plastic. I guess the plastic bags would fall into a category of what we would call films, so very thin sheets of plastic. Most of what we collect are fragments and filaments. And so filaments might come from clothing that then went through wastewater treatment. So that's kind of a big unknown in terms of worst offenders, is the extent to which plastics go through the wastewater treatment process. But again, we collect a lot of fragments as well. So these would be sort of thicker chunks of plastic that might come from bottles. They might come from a variety of sort of thicker, larger plastics.
John Cohen, what sort of fisheries are in the Delaware Bay, and what are you hearing from the men and women who operate them about plastics?
So in terms of Delaware, the most valuable commercial fishery is blue crabs. And then there are some oyster fisheries, and then there's sort of an aquaculture fishery that's coming not so much in Delaware Bay, but in the Delaware Inland Bays. And so I think what we hear is there's some concern over the issue, not so much that you're seeing fish sort of covered in plastic, but I think there's a concern about the issue and the idea that you want to make sure that the product that you pass on is of the highest quality and isn't contaminated. And so I think whether it's the Department of Natural Resources or the fishermen, the concern is to have a product that you can trust. And so I think that's something that we're interested in ensuring is the case in our sampling, just to make sure that that's...
And this is WHYY in Philadelphia. A couple of years ago, the Delaware Sea Grant Program was in danger of being chopped as the Trump administration wanted to cut funding for grants from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association. What does the Sea Grant Program allow you to do, and what has become of it?
Sure. So the Sea Grant Program is alive and well. It's funding a variety of science work and outreach work to the public. It's actually played a huge role in our study of microplastics. It's provided initial seed funding several years ago to start doing a lot of this work, and then we're currently operating under a 2-year grant to continue that. And it's going to allow us to engage, for example, in some newer grant funding that you already mentioned with others. It's going to sort of facilitate that collaboration. So in a lot of ways, it sort of created a baseline of information for microplastics in the Delaware estuary that others are going to be building on and we're going to build on as well. And then it's a robust program that has an impact, not just for scientific research, but also for community development and education, which are goals of the Sea Grant College program. And so I think, again, it's doing well.
Two thumbs up, hoping the support continues, right?
Exactly.
So, John, just we have about a minute left. If you could outline for us what needs to happen step by step to get the problem of microplastics under control and even eradicate it over, say, the next 10 years.
Sure. So I feel like as consumers and just citizens, if we increase our awareness of the kinds of plastics we use, particularly single-use plastics, and also concentrate on, as you mentioned, storm drains. And so the idea that these things are connected to some water body, so how much the waste that we do produce, that it gets handled properly, it gets recycled if possible. So all of those things on the land need to happen. And then in terms of the water, we need to get a better sense of the impacts that we are seeing in terms of plastics and focus our attention on areas that we see as being sort of highly polluted areas, and also areas in the water where cleanup mechanisms, as they perhaps get developed, which they're not really in place now, perhaps we could focus. It's a large area, and so we really need to learn more about where the big issues are.
All right, Jonathan Cohen, thanks so much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Jonathan Cohen is associate professor at the University of Delaware College of Earth, Ocean, and Environment School of Marine Sciences and Biology. And as always, if you'd like to learn more about us, head to whyy.org/radiotimes. You'll find links to social media and access to some terrific podcasts. Our engineer today was Adam Staniszewski. Our producers are Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Great to have you along for Radio Times.